April is Poetry Month, which means that there are some really good poetry books being published this month. My guest, Robert Haas, is responsible for two of them. He edited a new collection called Song of Myself and Other Poems by Walt Whitman. We'll talk with him about Whitman a little later this month. But now he's going to read a poem about the death of his brother from his new collection of poems, The Apple Trees at Olema. Haas is a former poet laureate of the U.S. His previous collection, Time and Materials, won a Pulitzer and a National Book Award. Robert Haas, welcome back to Fresh Air. I want you to read a poem called August Notebook, A Death. But before you read it, I'd like you to introduce it to us.
Well, this is either a poem or a series of poems about the death of my younger brother, written right after, immediately after he died, a couple of summers ago. And the first poem in this series is called River Bicycle Peony. And it begins with a series of typos, so it's hard to read. Something like this. I woke up thinking about my brother. That, and then that was my first bit of early morning typing. So the first dignity, it turns out, is to get the spelling right. I woke up thinking about my brother's body. Apparently, it's at the medical examiner's morgue. I found myself wondering whether he was naked yet and whose job it was to take clothes off and when they did it. It seemed unnecessary to undress his body until they performed the exam, and that isn't going to happen until later this morning, and so I found myself hoping that he was dressed still, though smell may be an issue or hygiene. When the police do a forced entry for the purpose of a welfare check and the deceased person is alone, the body goes to the medical examiner's morgue in the section for those deaths in which no evidence of foul play is involved, so the examination for cause of death is fairly routine.
How did your brother die?
Well, he overdosed on probably on prescription drugs. Lay down. I will never know whether it was an accident or a suicide.
Was he lost to you already?
No, he was quite present to me, and he had just my younger brother was had cerebral palsy and had other physical problems, and when he was in his early 50s, I guess, late 40s, early, how old was he? Anyway, he could not walk anymore, though he'd just been in a therapeutic situation in which he was trying to get back some ability to walk. He was a street person. He was kind of a scoundrel in the way that.
When you say a street person, do you mean he lived on the street?
He lived on the street for a while, and then I decided I couldn't go through life with worrying about him being on the street, so I sort of became his, I kept an eye on him to see that he had a roof over his head. And so he lived in an SRO, lived on SSI in San Francisco on a street where full of people living in single residence housing with getting help from, they would get about $900 a month from the government and pay $500 to $600 a month in rent and get on the street with the extra money and hustle to get through the month.
Did your brother have a hustle?
No, he didn't. He never had a successful hustle, but there's a passage here that would convey some sense of what that life is like, maybe, if this would be helpful. It begins with today his body is consigned to the flames, and I begin to understand why people would want to carry a body to the river's edge and build a platform of wood and burn it in the wind and scatter the ashes in the river, as if to say, take him, fire, take him, air, and river, take him, downstream, downstream. Watch the ashes disappear in the fast water, or in a small flaring of anger, turn away, walk back toward the markets and the hum of life, not quite saying to yourself, there, the hell with it, it's done. I said to him once, when he'd gotten into some scrape or other, you know, you have the impulse control of a ferret. And he said, yeah, I don't know what a ferret is, but I get greedy. I don't mean to, but I get greedy. An old grubber's beard going gray, wheelchair, sweats, a street person's baseball cap. I've been thinking about Billie Holiday, he said. You know, if she were around now, she'd be nothing. You know what I mean? Hip-hop? Never. She had to be born, see, at a time when they were listening, when they were writing the kinds of songs and people were listening to the kinds of songs. She was great at singing. And I would say, you just got evicted from your apartment. You can't walk. You have no money. So I don't want to talk to you about Billie Holiday right now, okay? And he would say, you know, I'm like Mom. I mean, she really had a genius for denial, don't you think? And the thing is, you know, she was a pretty happy person. So on. Anyway, a portrait of...
Well, that's great.
He didn't have a hustle. He had a way of staying alive.
So did he have... You mentioned he had cerebral palsy and couldn't walk, but did he have mental problems too?
No. I mean, he had mental problems in that he was incapable of showing up for three consecutive days if you asked him to, so he could never hold down a job. But he was, you know, he had a wide curiosity and he was extremely manipulative person, but he wasn't crazy.
And it didn't upset him to live in an SRO or on the street.
He didn't like living on the street, and he was terrified at the end of his life because he'd sort of run out of scams that he might end up on the street.
It's just one of those crazy, crazy family things, you know, where like you're a former poet laureate, professor at UC Berkeley, and your brother's living on the street.
Mm-hmm. For one period, he lived on the street. Well, everybody who has family like this goes through this business about tough love. You know, how much do you help people? How much do you let them suffer the consequences of their choices?
Exactly.
And so he went through one period on the street, and I, at a certain point, said, well, it turns out I'm one of the people who just can't stand this. So I saw to it that that his rent got paid each month.
So had you talked yourself into the tough love approach?
I tried. and he liked to talk about it. You know, I mean, he's perfectly interested in having long psychological conversations about it. He didn't have anything else to do all day except have long, ironic psychological conversations about things like that. So he enjoyed it.
Can I just ask you, this is very personal, but were you surprised by what you felt after your brother's death?
Yeah. I was surprised. I was very surprised by his death, first of all. I wasn't expecting it. I'd seen him a few days before and thought he was going to be okay for a while. And I don't, in truth, know whether he killed himself or not. And he had a couple of times threatened to kill himself he would say, if I don't get this money to pay so and so, or if I don't get this money to, I don't want to live. And I would say, you're telling me that if I won't give you $300, you're going to kill yourself? And he'd say, no, I know that's crazy. And he would laugh and make another joke. So it was there. But he seemed in good spirits. And he seemed, I don't think I can do this narrative. But yes, I was surprised that he died. I was surprised at how much I missed him. The minute he was gone, how much I missed him. He didn't have anything else to do, so we talked on the phone quite a lot. He dropped out of school and I think his sophomore year of high school, so he got his education watching. He discovered the History Channel when he was in his 30s, and he would call me to tell me this amazing thing that he learned about Andrew Carnegie or about World War I. And And so he was all, he was interesting, to, and he had many funny stories about the life that he lived, the people he lived among. Yeah, I missed him. I miss him still.
Why did you decide to write a poem about your brother and his death?
I didn't. I just, you know, what poets do is sit down in the morning and write and see, and there it was. So I just kind of kept, wrote my way through what came to me.
Maybe the best way to end our conversation is to ask you to read the end of the poem for your brother.
Mm-hmm. I can read a part of the poem that will feel like an envoy, and that was in a way got the sort of ground tone of what I was, the way I was feeling that loss. You can fall a long way in sunlight. You can fall a long way in the rain. The ones who don't take the old white horse take the evening train.
Thank you so much for
thanks, Terry.
Reading part of the poem about your brother and for talking with us about him. It's great to talk with you again.
Thank you very much.
Robert Hass's new collection of poems is called The Apple Trees at Olema. You can read the full text of his elegy to his younger brother on our website, freshair.npr.org. Later this month, we'll talk with Hass about his new collection of Walt Whitman poems.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. Since the health care overhaul became law, we've been taking a closer look at some of its provisions. Today, we examine 2 points, beginning with the bill's language on abortion. Abortion opponents describe the new law as a major expansion of abortion rights, but that is not at all how abortion rights advocates view things. They see this as a potential rollback of insurance coverage for abortion that many women have now. And as NPR's Julie Robner reports, several states are already moving to make that rollback a reality.
As the new health law was being written, the uneasy truce between abortion rights supporters and opponents was this: the law should neither expand nor contract existing abortion policy. Federal abortion funding is currently allowed in cases of rape, incest, or when the life of the woman would be endangered by carrying the pregnancy to term. But where that got complicated was in the new health insurance marketplaces the law calls for. They're called exchanges. That's where the federal government would subsidize many people's private policies. One option in the law would let states ban all abortion coverage in the exchanges. Charmaine Yost, president and CEO of the anti-abortion group Americans United for Life, said her group wasted no time drawing up a model state law to that effect. They sent it out the day after Congress approved the health bill.
It was a part of the legislation, and so we had a heads up, and we moved right in to make sure that we could equip states with the tools that they need to have the most effective opt-out possible.
So far, at least 3 states, Missouri, Tennessee, and Louisiana, are already moving to ban abortion coverage in the exchanges, and that's even though the exchanges themselves don't have to be up and running until the year 2014. But even without new state laws, abortion rights advocates say the new federal health law is likely to make abortion less available for many women.
In general, it has been the norm that private health plans provide abortion coverage.
Judy Lichtman is with the National Partnership for Women and Families, which supports abortion rights. She says the law, in theory, allows health insurance plans in the exchanges to offer abortion coverage.
However, it does so in a way that creates really serious disincentives to providing the coverage and very serious disincentives from people buying it.
Here's how it works. Under the law, insurance plans can offer coverage for abortion only if they offer it as a separate policy. Individuals or their employers will have to write 2 separate checks each month, one for the abortion coverage and one for all other coverage, and those premiums will have to be kept in separate accounts. Timothy Jost, a law professor at Washington and Lee University, says he thinks that will all but eliminate health coverage for abortion in the new exchanges.
This segregation of funds and strict auditing of the funds is going to be a real hassle for insurers. It's going to be a hassle for consumers. And, you know, markets are going to lead people to the low-cost, low-hassle solution, which is plans that do not cover abortion.
And many women don't realize their plans don't cover abortion until it's too late. For example, in 2008, D.J. Feldman, a federal lawyer, had a fetus diagnosed with anencephaly. It's a birth defect where the brain, skull, and spinal column fail to connect. Her doctor said an abortion was medically necessary, but her insurance claim was denied. That's because federal health plans have long been barred from offering most abortion coverage. Feldman read from her denial letter at a news conference last year.
Our medical experts determined that you could have carried to term because your life was not in danger. And by the way, you owe $9,000.
Stories like that could become a lot more common for women buying insurance in the new marketplaces. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
And now let's follow up on those tax credits offered in the stimulus package. A report from the Treasury Department's Inspector General, which we find out about on this tax day, says all those tax credits have caused confusion for both taxpayers and the IRS. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
One problem is with the Making Work Pay Credit. J. Russell George is the Treasury Department's Inspector General for Tax Administration. He says the government has paid out too much in refunds.
So what's happening is the IRS is computing that Jane Doe is entitled to $300, and yet Jane Doe requested $500 and received it.
Overall, he says, under the program, the government has paid out roughly $24 million more than it should have. To put that number in perspective, tax credits for making work pay total $25 billion. Still, the inspector general is dissatisfied. The report also says the government gave taxpayers millions of dollars they weren't entitled to under the plug-in vehicle tax credit. For example, some people claimed a deduction for electric golf carts, which weren't covered. J. Russell George points to another set of issues. These involve the tax credit for first-time homebuyers.
The IRS itself estimates that over 50% of the individuals claiming the first-time credit will not be complying with that requirement to supply proof that they actually purchased a home.
The report wasn't all bad news for the IRS. The inspector general says the agency is detecting more fraudulent returns than in the past, and it's stopping more of those taxpayers from getting refunds they don't deserve. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.